In our series through church history, we've come now to our 10th lecture. And in this particular lecture, we're going to begin talking about what I call the Christian Empire period, and then the early period of that phase, the Christian Empire. Let me just show you the three periods of church history that we've mentioned so far. First of all, we talked about the Apostolic Church. That's 33 to 100 AD, approximately. Then we talk about the period that we call the early church. That's approximately from the death of the apostles to the conversion of the Roman Emperor Constantine, about 312 AD. And now we're going to begin in the section that we call the Christian Empire, which I've divided into an early period and a later period, because in this period of the Christian Empire, it composes some 1,200 years, and of course, so much happened in the history of Christianity during that period that it's helpful just to subdivide it into one section leading up to about the year 1000, and then another section leading up to the period of 1000 to 1500. And of course, these are all approximations. There's lots of overlap between the things, different trends, different periods, but we're just getting a general idea of how to organize all of this. Now, in this particular lecture, what we're going to discuss is Constantine, the Roman Emperor, and Christianity, and mainly the effect that the conversion of the Roman Emperor Constantine had upon the Christian faith and the history of the church. It would be helpful if we begin by considering Christianity in the Roman Empire just before Constantine. You know, if we consider that the church and the history of the church begins, historically speaking, somewhere around Pentecost, the year 30 AD or around that, if we take that as the particular figure somewhere in that neighborhood, then basically you have from AD 30 up until the beginning of the 4th century, when Christianity continues to expand, multiply throughout the Roman Empire. And in the last 50 years of that period or so, it's expanding much faster. There's a much greater rate of growth of the Christian faith, where it just sort of carried along and then began to grow more and more rapidly towards the end of the 3rd century and the beginning of the 4th century. And this was matched from time to time by tremendous outpourings of persecution in the Roman Empire. As we've discussed before in the lecture that we did on persecution, nobody should think that persecution in the Roman Empire was constant. In other words, you know, all up until the conversion of Constantine, Christians were always being persecuted, nor was it, generally speaking, universal. It tended to be more localized. Now, there were certainly some persecutions, especially the ones we're going to talk about right now, which were more universal in character. I mean, a ruling or a decree went out from the Roman Empire, emperor, I want Christians persecuted all over the empire. And of course, it was up to local officials to carry such things out. But in general speaking, some of these latter persecutions were the most widespread and in some ways, the strongest, the most vicious. Therefore, at the end of the 3rd century and the beginning of the 4th century, it looked like Christianity might be doomed, or at least it would be beaten back to nothing more than an insignificant faith with just a few followers. There were some administrative changes in the Roman Empire, dividing many things between an eastern part of the empire and a western part of the empire. The western part of the empire kept its capital in Rome. The eastern part of the empire established a new capital, later on developed under Constantine in the city of Constantinople. But strong emperors such as Diocletian and Galerius brought severe persecution for Christians. In its church history, Eusebius described how some of these edicts of Diocletian really had a terrible effect on the church. Diocletian stands as one of the worst persecuting emperors of Christians. And so here, let's take a look at some of Eusebius in his history. He's talking about the persecution under Emperor Diocletian. Here's our quote. Diocletian and Maximin declared that the meetings of the Christians should be abolished. It was in the 19th year of the reign of Diocletian that imperial edicts were published everywhere, commanding that churches be leveled to the ground and that the scriptures be destroyed by fire, and ordering that those who held places of honor be degraded, and that they of Caesar's household, if they persist in their profession of Christianity, be deprived of freedom. Such was the first edict against us. But not long after, other decrees were issued, commanding that all the rulers of the churches in every place be thrown into prison and afterwards by every means be compelled to sacrifice to the pagan gods. Eusebius, I think, gives us a good feeling as just such the depths, the widespread nature of this terrible persecution under Diocletian, and then just how strongly it affected the church as well. So starting in the year 298, one of the successors to Diocletian, Galerius, or actually an associate, this was at a concurrent time, he expelled all Christians out of the army and government jobs. And then in the year 303, this tremendous persecution began, again, described previously by Eusebius. Churches were destroyed, scriptures were seized and burned, and Christian services were prohibited. Again, it looked like Christianity might be stamped out. But then, at this amazing time when the church was being terribly, terribly persecuted in the Roman Empire, two remarkable things happened. The first remarkable thing was the issue of the Edict of Toleration. And this was issued by Galerius. Emperor Galerius had been a great persecutor of the church. But quite surprisingly, he issued the Edict of Toleration on his deathbed. You see, without admitting that he had been wrong before, Galerius declared that he admired the determination and the tenacity of Christians in the face of persecution. And he decided that for the good of the empire, Christians should be allowed to meet as long as they were orderly about it. He decided to make Christianity a permitted religion in the Roman Empire. Now, he also asked Christians to pray to their God for the good of the empire. And this established a significant official declaration of the toleration of Christianity in the Roman Empire. And again, this came as quite a shock. Galerius had been a persecuting emperor, and he made this declaration on his deathbed. And seemingly, at least one contributing cause to this was the bravery of Christians in the face of the terrible death and torture. That, at least in part, that is what changed the heart of this very hardened Roman emperor. Let's take a look at a few paragraphs from this Edict of Toleration issued by Emperor Galerius. And again, the date we have for this is April 30th, 311. And again, I just want to stress with you what a remarkable change this was. That an emperor who had been so vigorous in persecuting Christians now was saying that they should be tolerated. Okay, let's read some of this, the Edict of Toleration. Among our other regulations for the permanent advantage of the public good, we have so far attempted to bring all things into conformity with the ancient laws and public discipline of the Romans. It has especially been our goal that the Christians, who also abandoned the religion of their forefathers, he means the Roman religions, should return to right opinions, he means the Roman religions. We don't know why such stubbornness and foolishness took hold of the Christians, so that instead of honoring those ancient institutions, which perhaps their own ancestors had established, they, through caprice, made laws to themselves and drew together into different societies many men from widely different backgrounds. After the publication of our edict, commanding the Christians to observe the ancient institutions, many of them were persuaded through the fear of danger, and many were exposed to punishment. Let me just sort of pause right there. Yes, no fooling, Galerius. You were the one who gave them this great danger. You were one of the Roman emperors who exposed them to this great punishment. Yes, of course. Yes, the Christians were persecuted. This is what you're admitting in this document. Now back to this Edict of Toleration. Nevertheless, because of great numbers still persist in their opinions. In other words, he's saying, because there's so many Christians. And because we have understood that at present they neither pay reverence and due adoration to the gods, he means the Roman gods, of course, nor yet worship their own God, therefore we, from our desire, generosity, and giving pardon to all, have judged it fit to extend our generosity to those men and to permit them again to be Christians and to establish the places of their religious assemblies, yet so that they offend not against good order. Now, again, do you see what he's saying there? He's saying, yes, we recognize that the Christians don't worship the Roman gods, yet we won't allow them to worship their own God. So let's begin to allow them to worship their own God. And then finally, this little section from the Edict of Toleration, Galerius declared, wherefore it will be the duty of Christians in return for our toleration to pray to God for our benefit and for the public good, and for their own good, that the public good may continue safe in every place, and that they themselves may live securely in their homes. So again, Galerius just saying that we want Christians to pray for us. This is sort of what they need to do for us because we're doing something for them. Now again, you just have to admit this is genuinely remarkable. Such a free and open declaration that Christianity shall be permitted within the Roman Empire, and it being done by an emperor who was well known for his very vicious persecution up to this point. So that was the first remarkable thing that changed everything. Christianity was under terrible, terrible persecution. It looked like it might be stamped out or made just a very, very tiny thing in the Roman Empire. When all of a sudden, as a great surprise, Galerius issues the Edict of Toleration on his deathbed. That was the first remarkable thing. Here's the second remarkable thing that happened. It was the conversion of Constantine. And we date that to the year 312. Now, in October of 312, the imperial throne of Rome was contested. You know how this kind of things worked. One emperor dies, and there's instantly a rivalry, a battle to see who will succeed him, who will be the top man in the empire. And a young general named Constantine had the support of all the Roman armies of Britain and Gaul, that is France, to be the next emperor. I remember one time on a visit to the Minster or the cathedral in York, England, there's a statue of Constantine outside of there because he was the commander of those forces there. And he was the commander of those forces in Britain and Gaul. And he came down from the north to take that place of leadership, to fight his battles, to become the next emperor of Rome. He marched with his armies from the north to meet the armies of another claimant to the throne. His name was Maxentius. And shortly before the armies were to meet in battle, Constantine saw a cross of light in the sky. You know, some people think it was a dream. There are depictions of him having such a vision as he's asleep. Other people say, or Constantine sort of claims, that it was something that he saw while awake. But Constantine saw a cross of light in the sky. And he also read or heard the words in Latin, in this sign conquer. If my Latin pronunciation is anything remotely correct, in hoc signis vinces. Again, in this sign conquer. And what Constantine saw was some sort of figure or representation of the cross. Now, at this point in his life, Constantine was already beginning to reject the multiple gods of the Romans in favor of a single god. And when he saw this sign in the sky, some kind of cross or something similar to a cross, we'll talk about that in just a moment, he regarded it as a very important sign. Later, he said that Jesus appeared to him in a dream and showed him the cross sign again. This time, he saw that the top of the cross was bent over so that it looked like the Greek letters Chi and Rho. Those are the first two letters of the name Christ in Greek, Chi and Rho. Constantine believed that Jesus told him to mark his soldiers' shields with this sign. And so he did. That Chi Rho, looking at it in the English alphabet, we look at it sort of being a X superimposed upon a P, but really those are the two Greek letters, Chi and Rho, the first two letters of the Greek name Christ. It's an abbreviation for Christ. In any regard, Constantine did mark his soldiers' shields with that sign. They went into battle, and Constantine won the battle. And because of his position as Roman emperor, in a sense, Constantine instantly became the most prominent and famous Christian in the world. Now, when Constantine came into power, he gave freedom and official status to Christians. Before they were granted toleration by Galerius, Constantine took that, solidified it, and strengthened it. And in the year 313, again, just 2 years after the Edict of Milan granting toleration to Christians, the Edict of Toleration, 313 was the Edict of Milan, 311 was the Edict of Toleration. In the year 313, Constantine issued the Edict of Milan, granting religious freedom in the Roman Empire as a whole. Again, the edict declares, we'll read much of it in just a moment, but it declares, our purpose is to grant both to the Christians and to all others full authority to follow whatever worship each man has desired. So let's take a look at a few paragraphs from the Edict of Milan. Again, this was issued in March of 313. We read this. It seemed to us that, among those things that are good for mankind in general, the reverence paid to the divinity deserved our first and chief attention, and that it was proper that the Christians and all others should have liberty to follow that mode of religion which to each of them appeared best, so that God, who is seated in heaven, might be kind and helpful to us and everyone under our government. And therefore we judged it a good measure and one consistent with good judgment, that no man should be denied the right to practice the rites of the Christian, or to whatever other religion his mind directed him, that thus the supreme divinity to whose worship we freely devote ourselves might continue to extend this favor and goodness to us. And accordingly, we give you to know that, without regard to any provisos in our former order to be concerning to you concerning the Christians, all who choose that religion are to be permitted freely and absolutely to remain in it and not to be disturbed in any way or molested. And we thought it fit to be thus special in the things committed to your charge, that you might understand that the indulgence which we have granted in the matters of religion to the Christians is ample and unconditional. Continuing on, kind of a long declaration here. And perceive at the same time that the open and free exercise of their respective religions is granted to all others, as well as to the Christians. For it befits the well-ordered state and the tranquility of our times that each individual be allowed, according to his own choice, to worship the divinity, and we mean not to take away from the honor due to any religion or those it honors. Moreover, with respect to the Christians, we formally gave certain orders concerning the place appropriated for their religious assemblies, but now we declare that all persons who have purchased some places, either from our treasury or for someone else, must restore them to the Christians without demanding payment of any kind, and that this be performed immediately and without dispute. In other words, through these centuries of persecution, there were many buildings and structures that Christians built and owned that were taken away from them in persecutions. Here, Constantine goes to the remarkable step of saying those must be restored. And then finally, just a few more lines from the Edict of Milan. Constantine issued this declaration. And that the spirit of this our gracious order may be known unto you, we declare that you cause it by your authority to be published everywhere. Now, friends, I just have to say that those were remarkable and even revolutionary words. Constantine said this, that at the same time the open and free exercise of their respective religions is granted to all others as well as to the Christians. You see, before it was assumed by most people, especially leaders, that a common religion might be necessary to keep an empire together. But this, from Constantine, was a recognition of the principle of the freedom of religion. So what a remarkable change in a moment. Now, we'll talk a little bit more about Constantine in a moment, about his own personal faith. But just to have, in just a couple of years, go from terrible, terrible persecution to toleration to something of a restoration and even favor by the Roman government, well, this seems, you know, beyond comprehension. What a good thing this was perceived to be by the church. As well, in Constantine, you had an emperor who tried to do what he could to help the church. You see, as we read in that Edict of Milan, Constantine sought to restore what was taken away in previous persecutions. And then now government salaries would often be paid to bishops and to preachers. Sunday would begin to be recognized by the government as a day of rest. And Constantine also tried to help out some of the doctrinal controversies that divided Christians. I'll give a couple examples of those, but just understand this general principle. Now Constantine sees himself as a Christian emperor over what is at the very least a Christian-friendly empire. He wants to benefit Christians in the empire. And if Christians are fighting with each other about different doctrines, which of course they did in the first three centuries, then Constantine sees it as in his interest to help get these things resolved. And in two specific areas especially, I'm not limiting it to these two, but especially two areas did Constantine try to help the church resolve some controversies. The first is in what is called the Donatist controversy. Now, the Donatists were a strict group of Christians in North Africa who refused to recognize a man as a bishop because he was ordained by someone who had compromised under persecution. Constantine and most Christians sided against the Donatists. It's a very interesting controversy. Maybe we'll get into it in a later lecture. But basically, the idea is the authority of a Christian minister in his office or in his character. Now, we all understand how important it is for Christian leaders to be of good character. But if you were baptized by someone else who later on went astray, does that mean that you should be baptized again? That issue was sort of the core issue at the Donatist controversy. And then the other controversy was the Arian controversy. We are going to talk about this more in a later lecture, but the Bishop of Alexandria, his name was Alexander, he had a controversy with an elder in his church who was named Arius. Arius believed that Jesus was not truly divine like God the Father. To oversimplify, he felt that Jesus was something of a junior God. Now, Alexander excommunicated this elder Arius, but Arius found others to follow him, and he started a movement preaching his doctrine. Constantine called a famous council that we're going to talk about later in the year 324, the Council of Nicaea, to settle the issue. But before talking about these specific issues, let's just understand how interesting it is that now you have a Roman emperor trying to help Christians settle doctrinal controversies. Never had such a thing been seen before. previous to this, if Roman emperors cared about Christianity at all, they only cared to wipe it out. They only cared to persecute it. But now you have something where apparently Roman emperors are interested in helping Christians to settle their controversies. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, we'll talk about that a little bit later. Now, I do want to talk about a question that is sometimes debated among believers. People like to ask, was Constantine a true question? Question. Forgive me for that. Was Constantine a true Christian? And that's a question that has been very warmly debated. There are people who think that Constantine was not genuinely converted, that he was not born again, that he did what he did only as a political calculation. Let me quote to you one author named Houghton, who says this. He says, quote, "It is very doubtful whether Constantine was ever a true convert. His predecessors had persecuted the Christians for political reasons. He favored them on similar grounds and showed himself willing to continue the policy of toleration, which had in fact been introduced about a year before he won his victory." So this historian Houghton says, look, Constantine probably wasn't a Christian at all. He was just a politician. And he could see that Christianity was becoming more and more popular in the empire, which it was. Even though it was being persecuted severely, it was growing. And he's just saying, no, Constantine was just a politician. He wasn't really a Christian. And all Constantine did was continue the policy of toleration. But I must say, most historians, at least most of the ones that I've read, believe that Constantine was a genuine Christian. After all, he said he was. And Christians in his day certainly thought that he was a Christian. I'm not aware of any Christian in Constantine's own time who said, that man's not a believer. Now, there are some people who point to the fact that Constantine was not baptized until right before his death in the year 337. But again, as I think I've mentioned in a previous lecture, that was a common practice among Christians in that day, because many people held that if you sinned in a significant way, or maybe if you sinned in a significant way twice after your baptism, then you could not be restored to repentance. So I believe that Constantine was a believer. I can't speak for the depth of his faith, of course, but I don't see any good reason to doubt that he was a true believer in Jesus Christ. Now, there's another person connected to Constantine that is of note in our study of his life, and that's Constantine's mother, Helena. Helena was a very notable person in her day. She's well known for making a pilgrimage to the Holy Land, Jerusalem, Judea, Galilee, and looking for places where biblical events took place. Most of today's traditional sites date back to Helena's search. If you go to Jerusalem today and go, where is the site where Jesus was crucified? Where is the site where, you know, this happened, where that happened? Most of that dates back to Helena's time. And how reliable is that? Well, let's face it, it's some 300 years after those events take place. And some of these things have not very good historical foundation. For example, the legend goes that Helena had a dream in which she saw Mount Calvary being excavated, you know, dug out. Going to Jerusalem, she found Jesus's tomb, and she saw three crosses nearby with the inscription that Pilate had written separate from any of the crosses. And to find out which of the three crosses was the true cross, they touched a sick woman with each of the three, and at the touch of the third cross, the woman was healed. So then what did Helena do with the cross? Well, part of it was set in silver and was to be kept at Jerusalem. The nails were still in the cross. One of those nails was attached to the emperor's battle helmet, and another was attached to the bridle of his horse. Now, you can tell just from my telling of that, that's probably legendary. I mean, come on, the idea that the sign commanded to be made by Pontius Pilate, this is Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, the idea that that would still be laying around the actual cross is extremely unlikely 300 years later. It's unlikely that the wood itself would last 300 years later. But again, this is a very strong idea in the history of Christianity. You see it a lot of times in iconography. You see Constantine on one side, his mother on another side, and a cross in the middle. Because according to this kind of legend or this thinking, she was the discoverer of what they call the true cross. Now, over the years, thousands of small pieces of wood were set in the altars of churches and monasteries, and it was all claimed that those small pieces of wood were pieces of the true cross of Jesus Christ. By the time of Martin Luther, Luther said that there was enough wood in all of those pieces of the true cross around the world that you could put them all together and build a ship out of that. So, I mean, obviously, these are just superstitious relics. They're not true, they're not connected, but Helena was important in the formation, the development of those ideas. Now, after Constantine rose to prominence, the social and spiritual environment for Christians was very different in the Roman Empire. It's important to understand that for the Christians who saw this rapid change, it seemed to be nothing but a tremendously positive miracle from God. God had changed the hearts of two Roman emperors. The first, Galerius, by the courage of dying Christians, and the second, Constantine, through his personal salvation. In an amazingly short period of time, the church was in a completely different environment. It went from persecuted to privileged. You see, for centuries, the church had been a counter-cultural movement. Now it had to deal with the problems of power in a completely different way. You see, after the changes set in by Constantine and his followers began to take place, now only Christians might be promoted in the government and in the army. And you know how it is. If only Christians are going to be promoted in the government or in the army, then many people will become Christians just because that's the way to get promoted, to get along. In addition, the whole appearance of the church changed. There very quickly developed a much greater emphasis on ceremony, on pomp, on elaborate decorations, on grandeur, on riches. Looking back, we can say that the effect of the official recognition and support of the church by the Roman Empire ended up being a negative influence. Now, again, I just want to say, I don't think anybody could perceive that at the time. If you were in the year 314, 315, just a year or two after Constantine rose to power and issued not only this declaration of his own Christianity, but of granting favor to Christianity in the Roman Empire, I don't think anybody would do anything but applaud. They'd say, what a wonderful thing. This is the work of God. But over time, it ended up being a negative influence. And this is also seen in the way that Constantine and later Roman emperors tried to help in doctrinal matters. This complicated things tremendously. You see, now there was an official government position on controversial doctrines. Sometimes this seemed to be good, but in the long run, it was very harmful to the church. The church started becoming much more like a business corporation. And the emperor of the Rome was kind of the CEO, you know, the chief executive officer of the business organization of the church. By the way, Constantine also kept his title that was given to Roman emperors. It was given the title to them, Pontifex Maximus. That means He was the high priest of the pagan worship of Rome, but now he considered himself a leader of the Christian church. Now, please, Constantine did not consider himself a bishop or a pastor or a priest, but he considered himself to be the emperor of a Christian-friendly empire. Whether you would call it a Christian empire or not, that's a different question. But he said, I'm a Christian emperor, and we're going to go forward and do these things in a Christian way. For example, in the Arian controversy that we discussed before, Constantine's greatest concern seemed to be the unity of the church. Now, in one sense, this is good, because the church was highly united against Arius. And there also arose a problem, because Athanasius, who succeeded Alexander as the Bishop of Alexandria, Athanasius refused to accept repentant Arians back in the church. And Constantine tried to force him to accept these people. He's sort of trying to do the work of a local bishop for him. However, when Constantine died, his empire was divided among his sons. One of his sons turned out basically to be an Arian, and he forced an Arian doctrinal creed upon many reluctant bishops. And when the bishops appealed to the long-standing teachings of the church, Constantius said, whatever I want shall be, excuse me, let me go to the next slide here. He said this, whatever I want shall be regarded as canon or as truth. Either obey or go into exile. You see, now, under Constantine's son, Constantius, the imperial power was being used to promote heresy. And is this not the great difficulty that the church faces? It's sort of the two-edged sword of it all, is it not? If the emperor will use his power to promote good Christian doctrine, then maybe his successor, or two or three down the line from him, will use their power to promote and to influence things in a heretical way. But I think it's very significant that no church leader ever called into question, at least to my knowledge, the right of the emperor to get involved in these matters. They simply believe they made the wrong decision. They would say, well, look, Constantine made the right decision at Nicaea, and things turned out the right way. His son, Constantius, made the wrong decision favoring the Arians. See, later, Athanasius openly declared his belief that the emperor simply didn't have any business ruling in doctrinal matters. But this was a little bit after these things, and again, done by Athanasius some years later. Now, again, if we're talking about the Roman emperors after Constantine, we're talking about Constantine's sons. They were also Christians, but not necessarily true or faithful Christians. Again, Constantius and his, you know, associates continued the practice of intervening in matters of the church. They also did something that Constantine did not do. They tried to stamp out paganism. Now, if you remember, the policy of Constantine was freedom of religion. The policy of some of his followers, such as Constantius, their policy was to fight against paganism. Constantius closed the pagan temples. He prohibited sacrifice to the old pagan gods, and there was a death penalty for violating that decree. After Constantius, a nephew of Constantine, who was named Julian, came to the throne. Emperor Julian is a very interesting case. He barely survived a massacre of his entire family, who were killed by soldiers who wanted to prevent any threat of the sons of Constantine becoming the next emperors. He was trained by Arian teachers, and he developed an attraction to Greek philosophies and to pagan mysteries. Julian became emperor in 361, and in the same year that he became emperor, he attended his last Christian worship service. You see, he knew that he would never be accepted as emperor if he was hostile to Christianity, but once he was emperor, he could show his true colors. At first, you might say that Julian promoted what we might call a diversity campaign. He wasn't against Christianity. He was just for all the other religions as well. He would allow and promote them right along with Christianity. He even spoke of rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem for the Jews. Of course, he did not do it, but he spoke of it. But as Julian promoted a return to the old Greek religions and philosophies, what he really hoped was that if he left the Christians alone, they would just fight among themselves and destroy each other, which happens, does it not? When this didn't happen, he started on an anti-Christian campaign. Julian took some of the old pagan temples that had been given to Christians, and he gave them back to the pagans. He started to restrict what Christians could teach. Now, he only reigned for 2 years. And he died on the field of battle in Persia. It is said, some of these are traditions, some are reliable history, but it is said that as Emperor Julian lay dying on the field of battle, he took his blood, you know, from his bleeding body, and he flung it up to the sky, and he cried out, "You have conquered, O Galilean." Speaking of the fact that Jesus, the Galilean, had conquered over Emperor Julian. Now, the emperors who followed Julian were sympathetic to Christianity and generally followed the trend of opposing the pagan religions and involving themselves in the disputes of the church. But right along this same period, into the 4th century, we have something interesting in the decline of the Roman Empire as an empire and as a political entity. Between the years 250 and 300, Christianity began to spread among a Germanic tribe known as the Visigoths. The Visigoths raided cities in Asia Minor, and some of the prisoners that they took were Christians. The witness of these unwilling missionaries introduced the gospel to the Visigoths and to the Germanic peoples. But the first leader of a more organized work was a Christian named Ulfius. He was born about the year 310. Ulfius had a Greek Christian mother, and he became a leader to the Christians in his area because he had learned to speak Greek from his mother and he'd learned the faith from his mother. In the year 341, he was among a party of Goths who were sent to Constantinople as a diplomatic delegation. There, he met Eusebius, the bishop of Constantinople. The last Roman emperor left his throne in the West in the year 476. He was deposed by German invaders. But for several generations before that, Rome was no longer a mighty empire. It was constantly fighting barbarian invaders. No longer on the frontier, the Romans always had to deal with barbarians on the frontier, but now the barbarians were coming to them, and they were fighting them in Italy and in Rome itself. Rome was sacked by these barbarians, these Germanic peoples, in the year 410 and in the year 455. And what it means for the city to be sacked was that it was invaded and plundered. Men were killed and sold as slaves, and women were carried off as brides for Germanic leaders. Barbarians began to occupy lands on the Italian peninsula, and they began to take possession of the region. In the year 476, a German chieftain named Odovacar deposed the Western emperor. He was only an 11-year-old boy. And with that event, the Roman Empire in the West was over. The Roman Empire in the East, centered in Constantinople, that's another thing altogether that we'll talk about later. during this period, and especially after the fall of Rome, the population of Rome declined radically. Pope Gallicus, this is the year 492 to 496, so at the end of the 5th century, Pope Gallicus wrote of provinces such as Tuscany that were almost depopulated. Almost nobody lived there. Rome itself, which probably had something like 1 million people in it in the first century, by the 800s had a population of about 25,000. When the Roman Empire fell, society became more violent and less urbanized. People didn't live in cities much anymore. And again, how did it happen? Well, about the year 350, the Roman Empire was still massive. It included what is today the Near East, North Africa, England, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, Spain, Italy, Switzerland, Western Germany. But then the violent invasions, mainly from the Germanic tribes of the north, began to tear the empire apart. One critical turning point was the Battle of Adrianople. This was the beginning of the end for the Roman Empire. The battle was fought between the Roman Emperor Valens and the Goths on August 9th, 378. It took place 10 miles outside the city of Adrianople, which is now near the city of Edirne, Turkey. Some people say that Adrianople is the most fought over city in the world, that it has seen some 15 major battles in 1700 years. But the bottom line is this, is that Valens and Rome should have and could have won that battle, but they didn't. It was truly one of the turning points of history. After the Visigoth victory at Adrianople, they were able to roam freely. They were unhindered by the Roman army that had lost perhaps 20,000 to 25,000 men. That momentum would bring them to sack Rome itself in just a few years. And it introduced a whole new kind of defeatism into the Roman thinking. They no longer had the psychological confidence to defeat the Visigoths. Even though they beat them in several battles, they didn't have the confidence or the will to finish them off. So the Visigoths worked their way through Greece and through the Balkans and eventually through Italy itself until under Alaric in 410, they sacked Rome for 3 days, and they only left Rome because there wasn't enough food remaining in the city for the army to live upon. But the critical turning point was Adrianople. Ambrose of Milan, Bishop of Milan, said of this defeat at Adrianople, "It was the end of all humanity. It was the end of the world." Now, the Germanic tribes established states of their own eventually, and they copied Roman forms as much as they could. Many countries and provinces of Europe today are named after these Germanic tribes. So you have France after the tribe of the Franks, England after the tribe of the Angles, Denmark after the tribe of the Danes, Sweden after the Swedes, Lombardy in Italy after the Lombards, Burgundy in France after the Burgundians, Saxony in Germany, Essex and Wessex in England after the Saxons, and Friesland in the Netherlands after the Frisians. And so again, this legacy of these Germanic tribes lived on, but they were not states and administrations such as the Romans had. The power of Rome, which was once concentrated in its legions, its senate, its emperor more than anything, that power had been split up into hundreds of warlords, chieftains. Life began on a new chaotic and dangerous way in Europe and in the Christian world of Europe. Sometimes you hear people speak today of a new world order. Well, let me tell you, after the fall of Rome, it was a new world disorder. Well, that's going to be it for this particular lecture. In future lectures, we're going to talk about what happened more when Rome fell and how the church stepped in to fill that void in what we call this period of the Christian Empire, the early period of it. I hope you'll join us for those future lectures. And so pleased that you could join us for this one, this fascinating subject of how Constantine and Christianity advanced in the early 4th century, something that was surely history-forming and world-shaking in its impact.